Australia has endured wildfires, rain, wind and hail, now a heat wave. On Insight, the ongoing firefighting there with help from the U.S. Forest Service. I'll talk with the U.S. Forest Service Director, Shauna LaGarza. She's in Washington, D.C. And we'll talk about the impact of the extreme weather, also that aircraft crash last week, too. The Iowa caucuses are Monday, finally. And today, we get a lesson in the state's election process from Kate Payne. She's co-host and reporter for the podcast Caucusland by Iowa Public Radio. And a new season of the new Millennium Concert Series at Sac State. It begins tonight with Randall Scarlatta and Gilbert Kalish. The founder and artistic director of the series, Professor Andy Luchansky, will join me for sound advice, and we'll hear a preview of the upcoming concerts. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's coming up today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. Cap Radio will again today bring you NPR's special coverage of the impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate, and that will start immediately following Insight. To the wildfires in Australia, that plane crash a week ago, and now a heat wave that's been making the fire danger in some parts of the country much worse. Shauna LaGarza is Director of Fire and Aviation Management for the U.S. Forest Service. You might remember that we expected to talk with her last Thursday on Insight, but the conversation was canceled after a C-130 carrying fire retardant and three American firefighters crashed the night before that conversation. Three firefighters on board did not survive the crash, but we say thanks to U.S. Forest Service for rescheduling the conversation for today. Director LaGarza, thanks for joining us from Washington, D.C.
Thank you very much, Beth. Thanks for having me.
So this heat wave is yet another extreme weather factor. What's the latest assessment of the firefight in Australia? And is the number of fires growing, the perimeter still expanding?
Yeah, absolutely, Beth. That's a good question. So Australia went through a little period about a week and a half ago of a bit of a cooling trend that came through the country. But just yesterday and today, it's starting to heat back up again, the next cycle of heat waves, dry thunderstorms and lightning and more fire on the landscape, more open line across many states in Australia.
So what do you know now about the crash that happened last week?
Well, it's still under investigation in Australia, and so we don't comment on that crash or just still a lot of thoughts and prayers. Just the Coulson Aviation, the air tanker, a company and the families that were involved in that crash. So we wait for the authorities to release that information from Australia before we comment on it.
Just those sad, on board.
Really sad news.
Yeah, 44-year-old Captain Ian Macbeth of Montana, 42-year-old First Officer Paul Clyde Hudson of Arizona, and 43-year-old Flight Engineer Rick DeMorgan Jr. of Florida. There are times like this when it becomes important, as I know you understand, Shauna, to say the names.
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's just, I think the job that we do in firefighting is it's a dangerous job, whether you're here in the United States, if you're in Australia, if you're in Mexico, Brazil, Portugal, anywhere, the firefighting job is a hazardous job to have with the aviation tools that we have with air tankers, helicopters, and for ground personnel. The risks are still associated with being firefighters on the ground, no matter what country that you work in. So we know that our firefighters are highly trained, and same with the air tankers and helicopter pilots and folks that are going over there to help them.
So they all worked for Coulson Aviation with a subsidiary in Portland. CAL FIRE's Deputy Director Mike Moeller talked with us last week and said this is a very advanced aviation company that has worked in the fire arena for years, has a long relationship in California. And because you led Region 5, you have a lot of experience in this area and with Coulson. Can you talk a bit about managing the air fight in firefighting and the air resources, too?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, you know, Coulson and like our other contractors that we have for air tankers, all great companies. And, you know, it's just so sad when we lose any of them. But as far as managing the firefighting flight from aviation platform or an aviation operation that happens. There's an air attack that's usually over the scene. You have different lead planes, and the air attack helps coordinate from the airplanes or the helicopters that are flying in the air with the ground resources. And, you know, the lead planes or the pilots of the air tankers look to see where they're having the drops, you know, to be safe to be on, where they're on the ground and to be effective for the firefighting. So there's a large and complex organization that's put in place to help manage the aviation aerial assets that we have on wildland fires.
What's been different in Australia compared to California?
You know, I was over there. Yep, I went to Australia in the beginning of 2020, and a lot of the same kind of a Mediterranean type of fuel type that they have over there in Australia, as we see also in California. Of course, the mountains aren't as high in elevation as they are in California, but they still have a lot of elevation change from, you know, sea level to some of their topographic or their mountain ranges that have, you know, pretty well fueled types. I think the differences, you know, I think there's more similarities than there are differences, Beth. And you know, it's hot and dry, and a lot of fire on the landscape, and a lot of communities that have been affected, and, you know, firefighters and their families and the public, and, you know, they're pulling for each other just as we do with our fires that we have in the United States or in California, you know, and the things we saw from the Paradise fires or Tubbs or Southern California, the old fire. You could just go back in different times of how it's affecting that community, and communities really pulling together and learning from the events of the fire and to, you know, things to do differently for the future. But I would say I saw more similarities than I saw differences.
Mm-hmm. To what you're
I guess the biggest difference I would say too is they have a lot of volunteers, and there was a lot of community pride in volunteering, and it was pretty amazing to see. It would be like, you know, your dad or your grandpa used to be a volunteer firefighter, and so then your dad was, and then so then you became a volunteer firefighter, and they have this, you know, training every Sunday where people go and they learn about, you know, how to become a firefighter. And so you see groups of people would be able to go and, you know, volunteer or work on their tankers, which are their engines that they have there. So some a little bit different wording on different things, you know, but very similar. We have the incident command system is international. You know, they use the same system as us. They may have a few different names, like a tanker, not an engine type thing of that, you know, or a different spot fires may call jump fires and stuff like that, but very similar.
Then tell me more about the impact to the people regarding this crash that happened last week and the connection that Australians were feeling and continue to feel toward Americans in the United States for the sharing of resources and the support during the fires.
Yeah, I think not. You know, the people in Australia are resilient. They've been through a lot. Their fire year has started earlier in their calendar year than normal, a couple months ahead of time, you know, in September and October. They were seeing fire activity in the northeastern part of Australia sooner than they would have. And, you know, I think the crash last week, there's been other fatalities that have happened also in Australia. I don't know them all with the exact number now, but I've seen them occurring, you know, just as we sometimes have too in the United States or other parts of the world. And it's sad. And I think the community is really bonding well together and helping each other out and in different areas as we would too over here. You know, and the overflow and the help that's coming in from the folks in the United States has been just awesome, you know, of things that we can help with, and not only just firefighting, but other ways for helping them rebuild and recover.
You're listening to Shauna LaGarza. She's talking to us from Washington, D.C., though she grew up in Northern Nevada. She's Director of Fire and Aviation Management for the U.S. Forest Service. Shauna, will you talk about what's happened over the past 2-3 years in the federal firefighting budget for the use of aircraft, maybe in particular these big super tankers, and how you look at the funding shifting that I understand is happening?
We did have a funding shift. 2018, we had the fire funding fix that came into place, and so that allowed the Forest Service to have a budget for firefighting and separate for fire response. And that's different than what it was in the past. In the past, we would run out of money trying to fight fires in the agency, and then we'd have to take from other departments in our agency to pay for the fire suppression. So We've got our new fire funding fixed, and we're very appreciative of that. As far as the different assets that respond to beyond fires, you know, I'm a firm believer it's the right resource, right place, right time of what you need. I believe in every size of air tanker and helicopter to help us for the fire front, and it's what the firefighters on the ground need that we in the national office make available on national contracts for them. And so if you're the incident commander on the fire and you need a different type of tool, then, you know, our job is to make sure it's already on a contract for you all to be able to have that asset to help interagency, any type of fire, whether it's on state jurisdiction or federal. So that's how we look at that for a budget.
In California firefighting under Governor Newsom, is there a shift to more states' responsibility in terms of some of the funding? And I know there's been this tone of resistance and some very public verbal battling back and forth between the Trump administration and the state of California. So let's take that in a couple pieces. First of all, in funding, is more responsibility being shifted to the state level?
You know, I can't speak for the state of California for what they have for funding, but what I can tell you is that fire knows no boundaries. And we're all about mutual aid and the interagency firefighting efforts. My time that I've spent in this job across many parts of the country and in California, including Southern California, we have a great bond, whether it's local government, state, or federal workers, that we have pre-run planning cards. We go for the suppression, and then when it's all done, we work out the bills after it's done on that. So we're very committed to our interagency efforts in California.
What about the topic of land and forest management? I know specific terrain might vary, and forests across the country are as different as those from here to Australia, or similar, as you said. But what about the federal versus state balance in management of forests?
Yeah, so, you know, forest and land management across, whether it's state jurisdiction or federal lands, you know, the main things that drive fire are going to be, it doesn't matter what jurisdiction it's on. The fire doesn't know if it's a state land or Forest Service land or BLM or private lands, right? It's the things that combine the elements that make fires go, whether you're in America, the United States, or if you're in Australia. It's all about the fuels, the fuel loading that's on the ground. Those are your grasses, your shrubs, and your brushes, and, you know, the density of that, and your weather and topography. We call it fire triangle. Those three things really affect fire on the landscape, despite what jurisdictions, fuels, weather, and topography. Fuels is where your forest and land management fits into that. Like, we have been working very aggressively in the Forest Service, and I know with our partners in California and with CAL FIRE on fields reductions and thinning and mechanical and prescribed burning, and really working around communities for fuels reduction. And when you reduce the fuel loading, you know, around a community, that means there's going to be less of those shrubs and grasses, which means that there's less exposure for firefighters to get in there and really work on the fire and get the flames down to the ground. And then that allows, too, for the communities to have, you know, escape routes and be able to get out. And so a lot of work has been done in California, both federally and state. And we have a long ways to go, and we know that. And, you know, I think a lot of the importance is really, you know, pre-attack plans with your communities and really talking those types of plans through, like, where do we need to look at the risks that are associated around a community or on a landscape or a watershed, and how do we come together across boundaries to really work on those projects to make a difference in that one part of the triangle, the fuels part of the triangle. Now, weather, we can't control the weather. It is what it is, and, you know, we'll always be planning and preparing for when we know we're going to have hot, dry lightning weather that comes in, and when we're going to have the Santa Anas. We prepare for that interagency with local government, states, and the federal, and the topography is, you know, fire likes to go uphill with the wind unless you have a Santa Ana or a different type of wind like we saw in Paradise or an unusual wind event, and then it overrides that topography. And I think the things that I think about a lot now in my career is I'm just really proud of the firefighters and the training, interagency, both state, local, and federal, that we teach our folks, you know, all about fire behavior and fuels and weather and topography to be able to help make the best decisions as they can and have those tools in the toolbox to help them manage that fire wherever it is on the landscape.
Shawna, you've had such a vast array of experiences on the ground, firefighting, at some of the biggest disasters we've experienced in the world. So to get to this point that the president continues to say that California's major issue with wildfires is a lack of forest management, even more so than climate change, and the governor saying the state's actually doing a better job with state forests than the federal government, I don't want you to step into the middle of that fight, but I am interested in what you believe and whether you share the president's view on what's happening.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. I've had a long career in firefighting. This will be, I'm going on 31 years. Can you believe it? Right? 31
wow.
years. And started when I was 18 as a young firefighter. Mm-hmm. And I think just, you know, just over time, I've seen a lot of, when I first started in firefighting, was a pretty unique season. You came to work in May and it ended in like September. And it was a pretty kind of a 6 month type job that I had. I went to school in the off seasons and stuff, you know, and then you would get these abnormal events every once in a while. I can remember some fires in 1990, 1994, some big fires in Idaho. And, you know, I come back to the basics that feed fire, right? And fuels, your weather and your topography. Those are the things that make fire go. And there's things that can activate that, whether it be natural ignitions, that could be fire, more lightning caused fires across the landscape, or, you know, we've seen arsonists in different parts of the country of that. And there's always cycles that happen, you know, in the weather systems that you have. And yet sometimes those too play a role in, you know, we had a pretty big winter, a winter ago, I believe, in on the Sierra Nevadas, not this winter, but last winter, a high snowpack, you know, and that helps with our mountains, and that helps with the fuels, you know, to be able to retain some moisture, to be a little bit more resilient if fire comes into their area. And so I don't think it's a one-size-fits-all answer, Beth, that there's so many things that allow for fire on the landscape, that it's a pretty amazing career to have been a part of, still be a part of. And, you know, it all, to me, Beth, it all comes back to having the most prepared firefighters that we have, despite your agency, and really working with the communities and the public so they understand, you know, how dangerous these jobs are that we do and how well trained our firefighters are.
Because of the career you described and the fact that so many people know you and you have so much credibility here, I think to hear your answer on this question is really important. But does California have a lack of forest management, a problem with its forest management?
Oh, you know, I think that a lot of places in the country have areas that we can work on forest management and land management, and that it's not something that we're just going to get done this year or next year, right? It's got to be a longitudinal plan of what are we looking for how we manage our forests across vast landscapes. And we have a long ways to go on that part of the fuels triangle that I keep bringing up with you on that, you know. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to comment with California has a problem or not on that. I know they're working very hard toward, you know, having improved management on the national forest or on the state lands or private lands. And I bring back that it's, you know, we're all in it together. We're all in it together, you know, and helping protect our national forests and having good active management helps for having resilient watersheds, which feeds water down to the cities and to the bottles of which we drink. And so that's very important to me and the food we eat. Yes.
Well, you know how closely California and anyone with experience in wildfire in this country is watching what's happening in Australia. So I appreciate, again, as I said, your time, the conversation here. I hope this is something that we can do again. And in that effort to Australia, continued safety and good luck.
Okay. Thank you very much, Beth. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
That is Shawna LaGarza, Director of Fire and Aviation Management for the U.S. Forest Service. She was joining us from Washington, D.C. You can find continuing coverage of the situation in Australia at capradio.org. Up next for us, what it's like to be in Iowa with the Iowa caucuses just a few days away. I'll talk with the co-host and reporter from the podcast Caucus Land. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. The impeachment trial of President Trump continues today. NPR special coverage, which you will hear on Cap Radio, begins after Insight. We are going to get an important compass reading on this year's presidential race Monday night at the Iowa caucuses. It is the first statewide contest of the election year. And to get a sense of it all, here is a clip from the podcast Caucus Land, which is produced by Iowa Public Radio.
Every 4 years, people basically have to relearn how the Iowa caucuses even work. Not to beat a dead horse here, but remember, this isn't voting. People are showing up with their neighbors in high school gyms and church basements. They're actually standing in the corner of the candidate they support.
In some of these precincts, there's hundreds of people, and they're arguing and bartering, and then they're all counted up, and the totals are run through this mathematical formula. And there's all these rules, and it's confusing. Sometimes I don't get it. Some of the people in charge of these precincts can get it mixed up, too.
To do this math is just insane. The flow chart it boggles the mind.
That's John Green, who'll be running a caucus in the city of Lone Tree. It's about 17 miles from Iowa City.
Yeah, I'm, let's say, a wee bit concerned. It's like Rube Goldberg comes along and he looks at the Iowa caucus and he's like, whoa, wow.
Do you know who Rube Goldberg is? He looks at something simple and then creates or cartoons something very complex and complicated. So I can ask the podcast co-host and reporter more about that. She is Kate Payne from Iowa Public Radio, and she is joining us from Iowa City. Hi, Kate.
Hi.
Glad to have you with us today. So a caucus can seem mysterious, especially if you come from a state that has a primary and casts traditional ballots. So what do you think about that Rube Goldberg reference?
It cracked me up, honestly. And it is hard sometimes for people, as you said, who are outside of the caucus system to see, you know, hundreds, maybe a thousand people, you know, walking across a gymnasium and yelling, you know, for one candidate and another. And there's a question of what is really going on there. Caucuses it's a very different process. There's no voting booths. There's no ballots for the Iowa Democratic caucuses, at least. It really is a party meeting where Iowans are debating back and forth and physically standing in their candidate's corner. So the dynamics here can be really different as people make those decisions.
Do you say caucus or caucuses? When is each word used?
So it's an individual caucus. Caucus is plural. Sometimes it is referred to as the Iowa caucus. I feel like Iowa caucuses is more correct, though, because there's 1,600 some of them across the state.
And what's the timing Monday for when the meeting happens and then the decision making when the meeting ends?
So it's all across the state. Folks have to be standing in line to get into their caucus site by 7 p.m. Central Time on Monday night. Now, there will be some satellite caucuses for folks who can't get to their regular caucus. Some of those locations will be at different times for night shift workers at hospitals, for instance. But by and large, everyone has to be there at their site at 7 p.m. in order to participate. And then it really depends. Caucus to caucus, how long that process can take. You know, in some of the more rural parts of the state, there may just be a couple dozen people there. And if folks have their minds made up, you know, they can get in, make their say, and go home. In some of the larger sites where there will be hundreds of people, it could be a couple hours for folks to get in their corner and bang it all out.
Kate, why does Iowa still caucus? And who would make the decision to change that? The legislature? The state lawmakers?
So, a lot to unpack there. Yeah. Historically, Iowa has always caucused. There's 1 year when they didn't, but otherwise, dating back to before Iowa was a state, Iowans were caucusing at a much different scale than they do today. You know, it really did start in people's private homes and living rooms. And now today, you know, again, in some of these large precincts to hundreds of people who are trying to participate. But the process of caucusing is deeply ingrained into Iowa's state parties, the Democrats and the Republicans. So they take this very seriously. And especially in the more rural parts of the state, this process is still seen as one of the best ways to get Iowans involved in local politics, to debate not just candidates, but also party platforms and positions. So they do take that very seriously. As far as the pressure to move Iowa with the rest of the country to a primary, there is pressure from national Democrats, from the Democratic National Committee. The Republicans in Iowa do not face that same pressure. There isn't that same urge to move towards a more open and transparent and accessible process in the way that the Democrats are under that pressure. But as you mentioned, the Iowa caucuses, Iowa being first, that is all written out in state law. So if there was a point in time when real structural changes would be made to the Iowa caucuses and to Iowa being first, that would have to be addressed by the state legislature, which today is controlled by the Republican Party. And again, they're not inclined to give up Iowa being first or the caucus process itself.
Say something more, though, about what Republicans will do Monday compared to Democrats, because as you already said, it's a different process for each party.
Yes, it is a different process. So whereas the Democrats will go into those gymnasiums and church basements and, you know, get into their separate corners, the Republicans do express their preference on a secret ballot. It's basically just a blank piece of paper that folks will write down their preferred candidate on, and those are tallied up and the results are announced and then sent in to the party headquarters. So it's still the process of people having to physically go to their local party meeting in order to have their say, but there isn't the same sort of debate back and forth that's happening in the Republican caucus. It's really just a secret ballot. I will say the Iowa Republican Party and the Iowa Democratic Party are really united around the Iowa caucuses. It's one of the few things that they really agree on. But whereas other states, other Republican parties have decided to skip their primary process and just support the president all the way, the Iowa Republican Party felt it was very important to go through the motions at the very least in order to assert their status as Iowa being first. It's very important for them to hold on to that. So where Iowa Republicans, you know, from the leadership on down are incredibly united behind the president, they do want to still go through, do the process, meet in their local meetings and hash it out.
You're listening to Kate Payne. She's talking with us from Iowa City. She is co-host and reporter for Iowa Public Radio's podcast Caucus Land. With what you just said, Kate, these days and weeks leading up to Monday, months perhaps, are intense anyway. But with the Senate impeachment trial underway, how is this year different? And what's the craziest schedule you've heard about in the last couple of days?
So it's definitely not what the U.S. senators running for the nomination would have intended. You know, no one really expected for this to shake out this way, where the U.S. senators, you know, are duty bound to be in D.C. for these hearings. Not what they intended at all. But we are seeing particularly those U.S. senators sending out surrogates. You know, Elizabeth Warren is sending her husband, also their dog, to come out and campaign for her. We did see Senator Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota earlier this week was able to carve out the time. She was in D.C., finished the hearings that night, immediately got on the plane, flew out to Iowa, you know, wound up in a bar, held an event, and then flew back for the hearings the next day. So they really, any way that they can, they're trying to make their voices heard. They're also holding sort of teleconferences, town halls for Iowans to call in. So really coming up with different creative ways to try and get their names at the top of Iowans' minds, even when they're still in D.C.
Do you have any sense of whether the candidates who aren't senators and can continue to campaign there have any kind of an edge? There was so much of this talked about ahead of time with the trial pulling the senators in and out of the state.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So Iowa, historically, it is a state that values those interpersonal interactions from candidates. You know, Iowans really do want to see, the most active Iowans really do want to see these folks multiple times in person at events across the state. And so to not, for a candidate to not be here physically in the state in these last days, that's tough. It's not what they wanted, certainly. And so we do see former Vice President Joe Biden, former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg, entrepreneur Andrew Yang, billionaire Tom Steyer, they are all packing their schedules in the state, sort of crisscrossing, trying to get that time in, getting that face time in front of Iowans while they can. But, you know, it should be said, many of these candidates have spent months working on a year for some of them, building out their organizations in the state. They've been coming to Iowa for months. So when you go out and talk to some Iowans, you know, will it make that much of a difference? It's up for debate. They've seen these folks. They know who they are. It's really up to individuals to make their decision now.
How are Iowans taking to the one Californian in the mix, Tom Steyer? What kind of reaction is he getting?
So it's been somewhat of a mix. Iowans do want to give these candidates their chance. There's certainly a sort of culture of, you know, let the folks have their say, you know, when they come to the state, which Tom Steyer certainly has been coming to campaign here. That being said, there's a mixture of somewhat annoyance as far as the incredible amount of money that Steyer has spent on fundraising, on television ads in the state, also mailers going out in people's mailboxes all the time. So some folks are a little annoyed. Others are deeply troubled, actually, by the amount of money that he's spent here in the race. And there is a sense from some Iowans that it's his money that is getting him on the debate stage when they would have rather had seen some of the other candidates stay in the race longer but had to drop out because they couldn't fundraise. So there are questions there for some of them of what's really helping these candidates stay in the race or not.
Mm-hmm. I want to get back to the podcast, Kate, and we're going to hear a clip that references some changes in the caucus process that had to be made after 2016. In this clip, we're going to hear Judy Downs. So who is she?
So she is with the Polk County Democrats. So that's the state's largest county where Des Moines is. And it's been on her to really go out and educate Iowans on some of the changes that are coming down. Every year, Iowa caucus goers have to sort of remind themselves because there are so many rules and so many steps to this process. But this year, there are some major changes, both with how Iowans will move through showing their support for candidates and also to what results will be released when caucus night wraps up.
All right, let's listen to this clip from Caucus Land.
After 2016, there were some close calls. Some of these precincts were decided by a coin toss. There were some hard feelings from supporters of Senator Bernie Sanders, who narrowly lost the caucuses. And there was no way for the party to do a recount. Downs has to remind everyone at the table why there are changes.
After 2016, the DNC said if you want to keep the caucuses, you need to figure out a way to do a recount.
Okay. So that feeds us right into what some of those changes are. How is the state going to do a recount if needed?
So this year, for the first time, there will be what the party is calling presidential preference cards. So for our friends in New Hampshire, these are not ballots, state leaders would have you know, because Iowa does not have a primary. you know, it is a caucus, but these are basically pieces of paper that Iowans will be able to physically write down the name of their candidate on and then hand them in at the end of the night. So the party will be able to go back, reference all of these thousands of cards that come in all across the state in case a recount is needed. Because again, in the past, these decisions are being played out physically in thousands of rooms across the state. There is no way in the past, there is no way to recreate that in the event of a recount.
Right.
In 2016, such a close race.
Okay, so there are a few other changes. There's going to be a lot happening Monday night. You know, Iowa has this history of either predicting or not predicting the eventual party nominee. Can you just give me a summary of that history and what kind of expectation there is based on the polls right now?
Yeah, so as far as the candidates that come out of Iowa, the Iowa Democratic Party has actually had a better track record of choosing the candidate who goes on to be the nominee than the Republican Party. But certainly defenders of the Iowa caucus will say Iowa's process is to winnow the field. After the Iowa caucuses, folks will have a better idea of who won't be president, because historically, those candidates drop out immediately after the Iowa caucuses. There are questions this year about how that may change, because the Iowa Democratic Party will be releasing three sets of results, where historically they just released one. In the past, the state party just released the state delegates. So how many delegates each candidate won to then go on to each level of convention. But this year, we will actually get the raw numbers of how many people walked into the room supporting each individual candidate. Yeah, so
we're back to Rube Goldberg now.
Yeah, so you can sort of think of it as Iowa's own version of the Electoral College, where you have the delegates and then you have the actual raw vote numbers. And what's going to be really interesting if those two numbers are different. If one candidate wins the most total supporters, but another candidate wins the most actual delegates, you can bet that candidates will be breaking down all of those results and spinning them in whatever way advantages them.
Sounds like Iowa's version of the 2016 national presidential race, right?
So there's the potential for that.
Yeah. So we'll check in with you at this point today. Who's leading the polls in Iowa? And I know there are two different polls, so there might be two different answers.
Sure. So right now I'm looking at the Real Clear Politics polling average of Iowa polls, and it's Sanders is up right now at about just under 24 points, then Biden, Buttigieg, and Warren. But we should say polls can change on a dime in Iowa. The poll that many Iowans and Iowa watchers will be looking for is the Des Moines Register Iowa poll that'll come out this Saturday. And so that is considered the gold standard of polling in the state. And each of those top four candidates have been leading in that Iowa poll at one stage or another in the race. But folks will be waiting with bated breath to see what that last Iowa poll tells us just days before caucus night.
Kate, thank you for the time and the caucus lesson and the terrific podcast by you and Clay Masters and Iowa Public Radio. I appreciate that you joined us today, and we'll look ahead with a little bit more information about what's coming Monday night.
Thanks.
All right. That was Kate Payne. And we've posted a link to the podcast series Caucus Land. You can find that at capradio.org. Up next, some terrific live classical concerts that you can roll into your springtime calendar. There's even one tonight at Sac State, if you're up for it. Music professor Andy Luchansky will preview the new Millennium Concert Series in Sound Advice. That's coming up next. And you're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. This is Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Some truly stunning musical talent is coming to Sacramento and does each year through the New Millennium Concert Series, which started with the New Millennium. It was started by Sac State Music Professor Andrew Luchansky, and this year's series begins tonight. Professor Luchansky is with me to talk about the season in Sound Advice. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Beth. Thanks
so glad
for having
to
me.
Have you here. Will you explain the caliber of talent and experience that you've been able to bring to campus now over all these seasons?
Yeah, it's been quite wonderful to have started with the great string quartets of the 20th century, the Guarneri Quartet, the Juilliard Quartet, the Tokyo Quartet, the Emerson Quartet, and then we sort of moved on to a period of the star violinists, Hilary Hahn and Sarah Chang and Pinka Zukerman. And this year, we have one of our most interesting years in the pure chamber music quality of all of these events. We've really focused on the chamber music, which was the original essence of the concert series. So all four of these concerts are people and groups that have that incredible community feeling that makes chamber music so moving to play and to listen to.
Here is a preview of the concert tonight, and we'll talk more in detail about it after listening to just a little bit.
Was verleiht ich denn die Wege, wo die anderen Wanderer gehen? Suche mir versteckte Stege durch verschneite Felsen.
So that is, do you want to introduce that beautiful combination we heard?
That's Gilbert Kalish and Randall Scarlatta. Mm-hmm. And they're both here from the East Coast. Gil lives in New York and Randy in Philadelphia. And they have an amazing partnership. They're great friends and great colleagues. And what's special about Gil and Randy, and it reflects in the program they're presenting, is they're musicians of extraordinary range, and the program they're presenting has great breadth. You have Fauré songs in French. You have Beethoven. It's Beethoven's 250th year, so we have a couple of Beethoven on the series. And then there's these Charles Ives songs that are quintessentially American, and Gil and Randy are at, like, the best people in the country to hear do this music. And I think there's something right now about Ives' music that reflects what we love about America, the kind of independence and stubbornness and wit. And I think it's going to be so moving to have this going on right now with some of the strife we have inside our country that's tearing us apart. I think everybody will feel together hearing these guys do this tonight. And the big work on the program is the Schumann Dichterliebe, which is the whole second half of the program on poems by Heinrich Heine. And it's the Poet's Love is the title of Dichterliebe.
So that concert again is tonight at Capistrano Hall on the Sac State campus. It is from 7:30 to 9:30. There are still seats available. We will post a link to the New Millennium concert series so that you can not only see and find information about tonight, but the entire season. So let's move on to the next show, which is February 20th. Would you introduce the guests that night?
Yeah, the Imani Winds are also a New York-based group. They play a lot at the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. They are an extraordinarily energetic, charismatic group of wind players. It's a wind quintet. And they do arrangements. They're all sort of composer-performer arrangements. They've written their own music. And on this program, two of the highlights are they've arranged Ravel's Tombeau de Couperin, which was written by Revel during a World War I. It started it in 1914, finished it in 1917, I think, when he arranged it for orchestra. It was originally a piano piece. And to him, it was him taking pride in his Frenchness, with Couperin being the sort of hero French composer. And then years later, Shostakovich's Eighth String Quartet, which I'm dying to hear in a wind arrangement. It's an incredibly powerful piece that was dedicated to the victims of war and fascism and written right around 1960. And even though I was alive then, quite young, it's not that long after World War II for people who lived through World War II. And he, living in Russia, obviously experienced it, the war, very intensely. So the Imani winds are wonderful.
Let's listen to a bit of their music. You know that sound, and if you don't, what a treat you're in for. The show is February 20th at Capistrano Hall from 7:30 to 9:30. Again, you can find the link through the New Millennium Concert Series. So many people are excited about that show coming up, Andy.
Yeah, I know they're popular in this very radio station.
Yeah, they are. This week's Sound Advice is a preview of the series, which begins tonight. And we're going to continue with a show that's coming up in March. This will be on March 24th.
Yeah, the Faculty and Friends Gala is an all Brahms program. So the first half of the program, very special, two high school seniors, Sean Morey, a violinist, and Karina Tsang will be performing Brahms' A Major Violin Sonata. They are part of a trio that won the major national chamber music competition this year, the Fervita Trio. It is amazing to watch the two of them. They're consummate performers, passionate about music, and mature beyond their years as players. And I'm super excited to have them here. And it's reminding me that this concert is connected with an organization called Music for Food. And all five of the performers, and I'll mention the other three in a minute, have donated their fees to the Sac State Associated Students Food Pantry. People don't realize there are students who come to college and don't have enough to eat. So we're excited about this. As well. Second half of the program is the gorgeous Brahms Clarinet Trio, and that will be performed by three people from here in Sacramento, three of the best performers in town, clarinetist Sandra McPherson, cellist Susan Lamb Cook, and our own pianist John Cosa will be doing the gorgeous Brahms Clarinet Trio.
We're going to listen to a recording. This is not any of the artists who will be performing at this gala, but to sample some of this Brahms Clarinet Trio, Opus 114, here it is.
Thank you.
There's so much beauty in that music.
Yeah, that's Brahms, one of his last works, and it has this autumnal feeling, tremendous depth and simplicity of a person looking back at their life, which Brahms was a very bittersweet life, great success as a musician, a lot of heartbreak in his personal life.
So the series ends, Andy, on April 15th. And by the way, that Brahms concert again is, or the Friends and Faculty Gala is March 24th. April 15th, the Miro Quartet.
Miro Quartet. So one of the great quartets in the country, the first chamber music ensemble to receive the very prestigious Avery Fisher Career Grant. They're based in Austin, Texas. They're the quartet in residence at the University of Texas Austin School of Music, which is one of the great music schools in the country. They're a dynamic group, mid-career. Those of us who play string quartets followed them when they started out with great promise. And a lot of string quartets can't stay together. It's a real challenging partnership and almost a marriage with four people in it. Mm. And they've remained together with one change of personnel. They're an amazing group. And we're super excited. They're going to do some master classes for our students while they're here. The featured work on their program will be Beethoven's Opus 59, number 2, which is just an ecstatically perfect piece. So we're looking forward to having them do that.
We'll close out with that music. As always, Professor Luchansky, it's a joy. Congratulations on this continuing series.
Thanks, Beth.
All the information about the concerts is on our website, the new Millennium Concert Series. And again, it begins tonight, and there's room if you can make it. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak with producers Helen Barrington and Kyle McKinnon, also Cynthia Lopez. Our technical director is Mark Jones, with engineers Antonio Munez and Anthony Van Hook. Thank you to Emily Zentner. Our managing editor is R.M. Sarkissian. Thanks for joining us.